Hi everyone, I'm Kay Jabelli.
And I'm Frieza Bastoon. This is Monopoly Attack. Now, today we're going to be talking about Microsoft. So you might wonder, why Microsoft? First of all, it is the mother of all digital competition cases. Every tech antitrust case today, in some sense or in some way, goes back to this original digital antitrust case. And it also meant a huge deal for the development of economic theories on platforms as a concept, network effects, etc. Also, after Apple, Microsoft is still the second most valuable public company in the world, though at times it's not even considered part of big tech anymore. You might have heard the acronym GAFA, Google, Apple, Facebook, Amazon, but a lot of people drop the M of Microsoft, unjustifiably. And then finally, but this is something for another episode, Microsoft's trajectory after these canonical antitrust cases has been interesting. It evolved from antitrust villain to the good guy, from defendant to complainant, or at least contributor to complaints by other firms. But of course, even today, it's not free from allegations of anti-competitive conduct either. Like I said, though, perhaps for another time. Today, we start with this big Microsoft case in the EU. There was an equivalent in the US, and it concerns, well, it's called the Windows Media Player case. Now, Kay, can you maybe take us into the origins of this case? How did it come to be?
Yes, the case known as Windows Media Player also started, actually, with a complaint by Sun Microsystems back in the early 2000s to the European Commission, DG Comp. One of the leading network players at the time, Sun, complained that Microsoft had infringed Article 82, had abused its dominant position, by reserving to itself information that certain software products for network computing called Workgroup Server Operating Systems need to interoperate fully with Microsoft's PC operating systems. So basically, Sun was trying to sell these Workgroup Server Operating Systems. These operating systems meant to network with client operating systems, which were dominated by Microsoft's Windows. They needed certain software to interoperate and properly serve as a server, as a networking operating system that was fulfilling its job in the market. And the commission investigated this refusal to supply this interoperability information, which then led it on to consider other allegations and theories of harm and other conduct that Microsoft was engaged in, including the integration or bundling of Windows Media Player into Microsoft Windows. At the time, Microsoft had a pretty high market share of around 90%, around the same market shares that Google has in search these days, and was a beneficiary of high barriers to entry and high switching costs. A lot of enterprises would be using Microsoft's operating system, and they were taking multi-product licenses as part of their enterprise solution and deployment. It would be hard to switch entirely. Then also on the retail market, Microsoft had a lot of relationships with distributors. It was the most popular service. It had a lot of software that was developed for the operating system for the Wintel standard or Wintel platform, which was Windows and Intel. A lot of software developers, which creates these indirect network effects because consumers buy a PC for the software. That means they need to have a lot of software available. And so the more software developers that are on a particular platform, the more attractive it is. And then at the same time, the software developers want a platform that has a lot of users because that's how they're going to sell their products. So they end up developing more for the Wintel platform, kind of a classic version of these network effects, which are used so much in competition analysis these days. Microsoft did not dispute the sort of market power assessment much. It wasn't a situation where there was another huge rival ecosystem like the Apple, Google, Android situation that we have these days. So it wasn't so much a fight around what is the market definition, but rather around the particular abuses. And like I mentioned, there were two main abuses. The first one, this refusal to supply interface information for server operating systems. And then the second one, the tying or bundling of the Windows Media Player. But let's focus on the refusal to supply first.
Right. Yeah. A lot has been said about this case. It's almost 20 years old after all, but we'll try and focus on some of the perhaps under highlighted parts of it, starting with this refusal to supply, which was more specifically, a discontinuation of supply. So the object here is interoperability information provided by Microsoft to, for example, Sun and other developers of these Workgroup Server OS. And for some time, Microsoft had been supplying this information, at least to a limited extent. It had disclosed this information necessary for Sun and others to develop their complementary products. But with a new version of Windows, Microsoft stopped even those limited disclosures. So this is not really a kind of situation where from the start, they do not offer any access, like we have, for example, in this classic Bronner case. Rather, it's access that was given first, but then revoked. Now, of course, Microsoft had some arguments why it was the right time to revoke that access or why that was only natural. But the more critical view of that is that Microsoft was using so-called open early, close late strategy. Now, this term is very much in vogue again. We were at the CRA conference a couple of weeks ago where Lina Khan, the head of the Federal Trade Commission, used it as something that we need to look into more, that we need to sort of appreciate as use of conduct more. And actually, it's already, I mean, it's an old term. It's already in the Microsoft decision, only not under that name. The commission there found that for some time, Microsoft needed those complementers, those developers of, for example, Workgroup Server OS, because they had a great operating system, but not yet the capacity to come up with all these complements themselves. But once they grew large enough and they could sort of spread their attention and come up with their own complements, well, then the value of these complementers to them, of course, diminished. And since they were in control of the platform Windows, they had an easy way to simply exclude them from the market in favor of their own complements, their own workgroup server operating systems.
Yeah.
So that's, I think, a crucial part of the case.
Yeah, it's interesting in the life cycle of a platform that basically at the beginning, you want to open and attract as many users as possible, again, to take advantage of these network effects, to create these network effects. Mm-hmm. And then once you have that scale, your incentives mature or change or shift, and you then end up being a little bit more extractive. As long as there aren't these other platforms and alternatives, networks that people can switch to easily or multi-home or what have you, if there is this kind of a strong network effect, then there's an incentive to be less open and try to proprietize or gain more of the benefit of that network value and claim it for yourself. It is interesting. I mean, on the other hand, Microsoft's argument, I think, if they do include certain features and functionalities in Windows NT and then upgrade Windows to a new version, Windows 2000, what is their obligation to continue putting those things into Windows 2000? Are they required as a dominant company to innovate in a way that benefits their rivals? Is this their special responsibility, EU competition law? And does that infringe property rights? I mean, this question of how much is their property, their right to exclude, their right to control what they've built, what they've invested in, and how much does a competition law limit those property rights, limit their exercise of those property rights and kind of trump and say, well, actually, yes, you built it, but this is such an essential facility for competition that others need to be able to share it as well. Well, what do you think about this essential facilities idea?
Right. I mean, that's really the heart of the case. These fundamental freedoms to conduct a business, to contract with whomever you like, to dispose of your property freely, and of any type of abuse in the competition law realm, refusal to supply goes against that. Because if you are found to abusively refuse to supply, you will have to start contracting. There will be a duty to deal with competitors. So for that reason, I mean, you have to carefully balance the interests at stake here. On the one hand, competition in the market. But on the other hand, also these incentives to invest of the company building that essential facility. Because if everyone has to start giving access to their essential facilities, I mean, or to their facilities, whether they're essential or not, well, those facilities are not going to be built in the first place. You need to guarantee a good return on investment. It's a bit the same idea of the patent system.
What about the scope of the access here? Was it basically to let companies copy what Microsoft had done with their workgroup operating system?
Yeah. So that was apparently not the idea. Sun and other interested parties definitely made the argument that they would be doing something new. They could not simply copy, certainly not the operating system based on these disclosures. Their idea was always to build complements for it, complements that would add to the operating system rather than copy it or replace it.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point, that this wasn't just the ability to copy and replace Microsoft. This was actually a unique aspect of the case. Microsoft had brought an interim measures request to the court to pause enforcement of the decision pending full review and argued that, you know, this would damage their property rights, allow copying of their intellectual property. And the court rejected this argument and said, well, no, this is not going to reduce the differentiation. Any implementation of this interoperability information is still going to require some unique investment and quite some differentiation. And there's going to be a lot of room there for the competitors who use this information to innovate on top of it and provide something better. And in fact, the studies showed that there were elements that the competitors were providing better previously. And so the likelihood was that with this interoperability information, consumers would actually benefit from increased innovation going forward.
Right, right. So maybe we should get into the legal test here. I mean, when does this refusal to supply then become abusive, given all the interests at stake? And the Court of Justice has a lot of interesting cases on this, Bronner, McGill, MS Hilt, to name but a few. But the underlying idea is that we can only impose this duty to deal on a dominant firm in truly exceptional circumstances. Now, what are those exceptional circumstances? In the first place, that facility, like you've said, must be essential or indispensable, in the words of the court, meaning that it's essentially impossible to duplicate it. There are no actual substitutes in the first place. But even if other firms wanted to, they could not duplicate this facility. So there's also not a potential substitute, in other words. And secondly, this refusal of access must exclude any effective competition on the market, on the neighboring market here for Workgroup Server OS. So I think those are the two main ones. There's also something about preventing the appearance of a new product. That's what we just talked about. It's not a copy of the OS. That's the goal here, but these complementary products in this other market that are better or more innovative than what's already available. And the dominant firm must not have an objective justification. So did the commission and then the general court who dealt with the appeal find that these conditions were fulfilled here?
Actually, they did. That's the interesting part. And I think overall, the aspect of the fact that this was a bit of a discontinuation of supply was pretty key, because it goes to the heart of a lot of these arguments and provides a lot of evidence that helps the commission find and meet these criteria that the court imposes to allow for reduction or infringement of, so to say, of property rights. So first on indispensability, the key evidence to me was that the purchasing decisions of customers were driven by interoperability. Microsoft itself even advertised that its server OS was interoperable with the Microsoft client operating systems and the Microsoft ecosystem. So that was obviously a selling point that Microsoft saw as important. And so for this kind of product, where the main function of it is being able to network and connect server and client PCs, it's pretty clear that being able to interoperate with the dominant client PC operating system of the time is pretty indispensable for you to be able to offer that.
Right. And there was just no way to get around Microsoft. For example, Sun couldn't reverse engineer this interface information. Basically, they had to get it from Microsoft, or otherwise, I mean, their product simply wouldn't interface with Windows, which is, of course, crucial if you're providing a workplace product.
Yeah. So then on the second test, the elimination of competition, again, there was this element of the previous experience with this. Microsoft wanted to say that this needed to be quite a high burden, that the elimination required the conduct to be likely to eliminate all competition, or that, in other words, there is a high probability that the conduct would have such a result. But the court rejects this very strict and high burden for the elimination of competition and says that what matters is that the refusal is liable or likely to eliminate effective competition. that brings into question, well, what is effective competition? How much of a limitation or restriction of your offering makes you not no longer effective? And in this case, the evidence was that competitors' market shares had declined relatively significantly. And the competition that Microsoft said was coming from Linux at the time as a kind of a counterexample to say, well, actually, look, it is possible to compete without this. The court distinguished the functions that Linux was used for versus the functions that the other competitors like NetWare, more direct competitors of the workgroup server operating system. So they basically said, well, look, it's happening already. Mm. And we don't need to wait until this competition is all eliminated before acting.
Yeah, it's really interesting. If you look at the graphs, you see Microsoft's Workgroup Server OS product going up and all the others going down. Of course, it's always a bit difficult to rely just on this decline in market share of competitors. And this is open to the argument of saying, well, maybe our product is just better. But here, that didn't appear to be the case. That was sort of rejected on that basis.
Yeah, you've got sophisticated buyers here. You know, these are companies that would switch. They're spending a lot of money on this kind of stuff. And so they wouldn't want to be stuck if they have better options. Mm. And so the court basically said, well, look, the commission, they have a certain margin of discretion and assessment. And in this case, it's not clear that they were wrong. And also, there's network effects. Mm. I mean, this is kind of the early prototype of it, but the court emphasized the fact that the more popular a workgroup server operating system is among customers, the easier it is for technicians to acquire the skills related to that product. So these ancillary services that are part of the ecosystem and part of the demand for this product, this operating system, those are benefited from the already existing number of users. And when competitors' market share declines, that can serve to put them in a bit of a death spiral where there are these strong network effects. So mm-hmm. that is also going to make them less effective competitors.
Yeah. And again, here, I think there was a sort of an important role for the fact that this was a discontinuation of supply rather than a refusal. Because if you think about a discontinuation, I mean, you were dealing with competitors first, so this must have been efficient for you. You must have gotten an adequate return on investment. And if you didn't stop dealing, I mean, there are basically two explanations, either something important changed the circumstances of the market, the circumstances of your product, or the second explanation for that is an anti-competitive objective, an exclusionary intent. And so this isn't super explicit in decision, but I think the background of the anti-competitive effects were found is also simply this logic of discontinuing supplies without another sort of good reason that you can point to.
Yeah, indeed. And I think that really comes into play on the objective justification, because whatever arguments you make, whether you talk about the copying of the property rights, the copying of the service, which was rejected, whether you're talking about being able to copy unduly and thus reduce competition and incentives to invest, well, that doesn't really work if you were doing it before. And as well, the problem with objective justification is that it has this switching of the burden of proof, which makes it very difficult, which is the court observed Microsoft didn't really make much arguments in terms of objective justification. So overall, the court was willing to find that there was no objective justification, or at least the commission was correct in not finding there to be an objective justification. And then, of course, we had already mentioned that this would prevent new products from entering the market. So those four were met. Hmm. And then the commission's decision finding an abuse for refusing to provide this interoperability information was sustained. And I mean, I think personally that, you know, if there's about an obligation to maintain the status quo, then Microsoft's refusal didn't merely prevent the appearance of new products. It kind of even reduced the level of existing competition by removing these existing network effects that competing workgroup server OSs were getting. Mm-hmm. To me, it's a little bit kind of a, and you see hints of it in the decision and in the judgment. It's less about removing input and more about removing network effects. and where network effects are a valuable part of the product and service, a valuable part of demand, as interoperability was here, that unjustified removal, I mean, the fact that they had the power to remove the network effects due to their dominance of the PC client operating system, I can understand why that was found to be abusive.
Hmm. Yeah, me too. And I think now, sort of after these years where you have a good exposed view, I think most commentators would argue that this decision, you know, sort of stands up to scrutiny, even though the remedies are a bit of a different question, but it's not yet time for that. Maybe we should go into this second abuse first, which gave the case its name, you know, Windows Media Player. So at stake, except for this interoperability issue, was the fact that Windows, in its operating system, integrated some of its other products, its applications, specifically Windows Media Player, so a media streaming player, as the name implies. And, well, who are the complainants here? Of course, the developers of competing media players, because once Windows already has a media player pre-installed, that will certainly mess with the demand for your independent media player, especially at a time where consumers were not yet that tech savvy and were maybe less likely to go looking for a second or third media player if they already had one. But here, I think on the tying aspect, also a couple of interesting things, but maybe the most important one, what kind of tie is it? How did Microsoft really sort of made a bundle out of Windows, their operating system, which, as we said, dominant, of course, and its media player at that time, not yet dominant, but of course gained a lot of popularity because of the tie. And yeah, so was it contractual thing? Was it rather technical integration? Was it a bit of both? How do you see that?
Yeah, I think that is kind of the core question when it comes to tying in the tech space and software products especially. There's can be a continuum. Either you do this kind of traditional industrial era kind of tying where you just write it in the contract that you're going to buy both products. The tie is no more than, say, put them in the same box or shrink wrap the two boxes together. I remember going down to Fry's Electronics in the Bay Area and buying software. And then sometimes they would tie stuff together by literally just shrink wrapping the two boxes into one package. That's the very weak form of tying. The real issue for competition authorities is when it gets to more technical integration of products. Now, some products you could say are you know, it's impossible to distinguish a separate product with separate demand from a feature of a existing product. So, you know, a silly example is the ability to take and receive calls. You would say, well, obviously, that's just one single product or service. But in theory, you could imagine there being an argument that, oh, well, taking calls and receiving calls are two separate products. But this is just obviously an extreme example. There's a whole range of stuff before you get into that very simple kind of contractual tying. Different degrees of product integration, the way the two the different pieces of software are coded, the way they borrow from each other's code or call upon each other when they're operating, and the extent to which code of one is embedded in the other. And I think that is the tricky part for competition authorities and why it requires a kind of a case-by-case assessment to determine, well, is this really two distinct products? Or is it really just one product that has a variety of features?
Yeah, right. Because that's really the threshold question for any tying case, right? Are these separate products? Because like you've mentioned, you can't tie two products together that are not separate. Then you're just dealing with one product and there is no tie even to be seen. And so contractual old school tying was to some sense present here because Microsoft had these contracts with OEMs, original equipment manufacturers, basically Dell and other PC makers that they sold their Windows operating system to. But in those contracts, they also put a clause saying, look, you can buy our operating system, of course, but you have to, on every Windows computer, also install our Windows Media Player app. That was the contractual part of it, sort of the classic tie. But they went a step further and truly technically integrated Windows Media Player in Windows as well. So they sort of buried the code really deep in the sense that you couldn't even remove Windows Media Player. And if you did remove it, it would damage the operating system because the two were so intertwined. So the functionality of other apps was tied to Windows Media Player, making it a critical part of the OS. So there was really, even if you went around the contract, you couldn't remove Windows Media Player.
I think that's kind of funny because it's like saying, well, if you tried to open a file, it would automatically open the file with Windows Media Player, right? And that is kind of a tying as well. Mm. And then it could be technical tying there. It could be coded that way mm-hmm. with the operating system if you've included Windows Media Player and you just tell the operating system, well, recognize these files as these are Windows Media Player files and they need to be opened by Windows Media Player and they won't be able to be opened by anything else. And then it does take some engineering work to actually bring up a kind of an option to open a file and recognize it with something else, or to bring up a choice screen, so to say, oh, do you want to open this with Windows Media Player? Or do you want to use one of the other apps that might work or might be available? Depending on what the status quo is, you know, how advanced this feature is, whether it's widespread, the extent to which it's been adopted by third parties, and whether there are alternatives provided by third parties on a standalone basis, all of that plays into it. And that was the case here. You know, you had a couple of others, including QuickTime by Apple and Real Player mm-hmm. by Real Networks. I remember that Real Networks was kind of magic because it would enable you to get streaming, even video content on like, I think it was like even back with 56K modems. I mean, it was a tiny little box, terrible resolution, but still in terms of the advance of media content available on the internet, it was mind-blowing at the time.
Yeah. I mean, so there were definitely competitors in this media player space that were not providing an operating system. So that in itself provided an argument for the commission to say, well, there's separate supply of this second product, so it must be separate. And that sort of proves that consumers also want to get their media player separately. At least some of them do. A lot of less sophisticated consumers will be happy to stick to the default at the time Windows Media Player. But yeah, so media players were considered by the commission as a separate product. So you get past this threshold question. Of course, that's not the only question. Then you get into perhaps the more difficult part of foreclosure. This is an exclusionary abuse tying. So the question is, well, are our competitors foreclosed from the market in a way that is harmful for consumers? And I think this was the first case really where the commission went into an in-depth actual foreclosure analysis, because in older cases, they simply presumed that competitors were being excluded from the market if there was a tie by a dominant firm. So if this exclusion followed simply from dominance. But here they really looked at whether competitors were foreclosed. And an interesting part that played into that is, well, was Windows Media Player the superior product? Because that could explain its rise to the top. But here, even more clearly than in the other limb of this case, Media Player was an inferior product. It was absolutely trashed by the tech press. Like you said, Real Networks was a good product, better one generally. And so when we see a market where the inferior product is winning out to the superior product, there must be something else at stake than, you know, competition on the merits.
And then there was another justification as well that Microsoft tried to put out to say, well, actually, we need to bundle this because people, when they buy a PC, they expect it to have all this stuff. And the commission basically said, well, the OEMs, the guys who are actually putting these PCs together, they can just acquire a media player from someone else. So you're foreclosing competitors at that OEM purchasing level. And so that as well wasn't quite the success that Microsoft hoped it would be, or the justification that they hoped it would be. I think it is kind of tricky, though, at the same time, because you could imagine in the future or there to be further development where a better integrated, you know, if the operating system came around that really was like media focused and had integrated the media playing aspects of it more tightly into the operating system at the design stage, you know, originally, it would be a bit harder of a case. But again, in this one, you know, Microsoft Windows had been out for a while. Windows Media Player was a new piece of software that came on the market separately. So it wasn't as easy to argue those integrative efficiencies or that would be lost by forcing them to sell a standalone version.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that is an important point. Integration, especially in software markets where products are already modular and interoperability itself can be an efficiency. So integration, you know, there should really be a concern for the justification stage. The commission is not known for accepting justifications, but when you see integration of two products in a digital market, you should at least, you know, duly consider it, even though the case in Microsoft was not as convincing as it could be.
Yeah, so in the end, because of this case, the commission won and Microsoft didn't actually appeal this one. So they went along with it, even though they had the right to appeal it further to the higher court. And as a result, they accepted the conduct changes. They provided the interoperability information for workgroup servers, and they sold a version of Windows without Windows Media Player.
Yeah, exactly. And you would think that they've sort of drew some lessons from that. For example, okay, we cannot tie applications, our own applications, into our operating system. But a couple of years later, in 2009, there was already a new decision on tying by Windows. And we can be maybe short about this because it's sort of a redo. It's simply, you know, this dominant Windows operating system, where this time they've added not a media player, but their browser, Internet Explorer. Which was, again, a bit of a story of an inferior product. Microsoft's Internet Explorer did not have the same performance as competitors at the time. For example, Firefox, Chrome, that was starting to appear around that period. So they didn't get away with that either, but they did choose a bit of a different approach, less antagonistic. They went with commitments. They told the commission that they would stop this tie by implementing a choice screen.
Yeah, I think that is the lesson learned, was don't let it go all the way to a decision and then have to lose on appeal. So as part of the remedy on this, Microsoft made available mechanism that would allow users to choose their browser. It did so with 12 most widely used web browsers showing up. Five most popular were prominently displayed and presented in a random order, and then the user could scroll to see the remaining seven also presented in a random order. I think it's interesting, actually, that the structure of this was now later copied by Android in their choice screen, their most recent version of it, as a result of the commission investigations. But that's not really the end of the story. Microsoft accidentally dropped the choice screen in a Windows 7 update in February 2011 and was fined a little over half a billion euros for that little accident.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much there. I'm philosophically a huge fan of this choice screen, because what you do with tying is take away consumer choice, right? So you have this dominant product, you add on another one, and consumers are going to be using it, at least in this context. There's a strong status quo bias, as consumers that are not that tech savvy might just stick to what's already on the operating system. So here you want to restore that choice with a choice screen. You know, people boot up their Windows computer, get to pick between five browsers, choice restored. At least that's the theory, which I think sounds solid. But in practice, there's a whole lot more to be said about that.
Yeah, there's a lot more to be said about in practice and what happens after these decisions and after these remedies are imposed. But maybe that's for another episode.
Let's keep that for next one.
Sounds good. See you next time, Friezo. Thanks, everyone, for joining.
See you next time.